University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers and performers to the campus throughout the semester to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents Susan Clark Woolley, Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine. Her topic is Weight Gain May Be in Your Genes, Eating Disorders in College Students Today. Woolley is co-founder and co-director of the college's Clinic for Eating Disorders, which was established in 1974. She has been on the psychiatry department faculty since 1969.
Good morning and welcome to Forum. Weight, diet, and body image seem in our society to be obsessions that both interest and perplex many Americans. The related problems of obesity, anorexia, and bulimia affect millions of individuals in this country, and some studies show that as many as half of the college women in the United States have experienced bulimic or anorectic episodes in their lifetime. The complications can be serious and are sometimes fatal. Our speaker today did her doctoral research on obesity in 1969 and has since then been a prolific researcher and writer in eating disorders and related fields. Susan Clark Woolley holds a Bachelor of Arts degree in philosophy from Antioch College and the Doctor of Philosophy in Clinical Psychology from the University of Illinois. She is currently Associate Professor of Psychology and Co-Director of the Clinic for Eating Disorders in the Psychiatry Department at the University of Cincinnati Medical College. She serves as consulting editor for a number of psychological and behavioral journals, is on the editorial boards of the Journal of Applied Behavior Analysis, the International Journal of Eating, and Women in Therapy. Journal of Eating Disorders, I should say. Her topic today is Weight Gain May Be in Your Genes, Eating Disorders in College Students Today. Following today's forum, there will be an informal talk back or conversation hour in the psychology department, room 340 in the Smith-Curtis building. Everyone is welcome for that session. In addition, Dr. Woolley has asked that persons who may be concerned about an eating disorder or know someone who is, who may need resources or attempt to locate assistance, should feel free to contact her by telephone at the University of Cincinnati Medical School. Please welcome this morning Dr. Susan Clark Woolley.
I haven't quite faced up to the fact yet that I need bifocals, so I'm having to go back and forth from one kind of glasses to the other. I imagine that some of you are here because you come every week. Some of you are probably here so you don't have to write that paper sitting back in your room. And I imagine some of you just have an intellectual curiosity about this topic. But I also suspect that a number of you are here because it's a personal interest to you. As Dr. Keith said, weight and dieting have become issues that affect nearly all of us now and really are sort of one of our national major obsessions. A few years ago, Glamour magazine asked us to help them do a reader survey that would look at the issues of how the women who read their magazine felt about weight and dieting. And so we prepared that. They were stunned by the response. They got 33,000 replies, which was the biggest reader response to a survey of this kind, except for a survey done on the same topic by Psychology Today 11 years earlier. They were also struck by the seriousness of the problems indicated in the survey, not only by the answers to the questions, but the long, painful letters written by many of the respondents. And although you probably can't tell too much difference when you open up Glamour, it did, in fact, even create an editorial policy change where they no longer use models of the same degree of thinness that they used to and have some pretty strict rules about what's to be said about weight and dieting in the magazine. But I want to begin by sharing with you a few of the findings of that study. Could I have the first slide? This looks at the question of how many of the people who answered felt they were too fat. Not surprisingly, most of the people in the group at the left who are overweight feel that they are too fat. What's more surprising is that most people of normal weight feel too fat, and that a very high percent of underweight people, 45%, also feel too fat. These were people sufficiently underweight to be in a weight category that the underweight actually represents a substantial health risk. And yet 45% of them are still feeling too fat, and other data indicated that the majority of them still go on weight loss diets. Could I have the next slide? This asks, which would make you the happiest? Losing weight, success at work, a date with a man you admire, hearing from an old friend. And as you can see, the winning response here is losing weight. I think this is interesting because the reasons that people give for losing weight are so that they will get dates with people they admire, be more successful at work, have more friends. But yet we see here the means has overtaken the end. Could I have the next slide? My husband thought it might be interesting just to look at the number of diet articles that have been published over a period of years, and you can see there's been a pretty brisk increase since 1955. Next slide. This is the same data, but it breaks it down into articles which appeared in women's magazines versus all other magazines. I show you this because you can see that at most points there are about double as many articles in women's magazines as in magazines for general readership. And this will be the first of many pieces of data which I think underscore the fact that this is primarily a women's problem. The patients of diet clinics are about 95 to 98% female. It is women who are chronically and obsessively concerned about their weight. Does this mean that men aren't affected at all? No, it doesn't mean that, but all the research that's been done on body image shows that these problems for men are substantially less difficult, that most men feel better about their bodies, and even if they feel critical of their bodies, feel it's less important to their life. And this makes sense because throughout history, men have been judged differently than women, a fact summed up pretty neatly in the little aphorism, men act, women appear, which I think says it all. It says that throughout our history, men have been judged by their actions, by what they do, but a woman's chances for happiness have been very dependent on her appearance. In fact, through most of history, a woman really had no viable social role unless she was married. She had to stay with her family and was sort of a social outcast. And what her life would amount to depended on the kind of man that she was able to attract and get to marry her, which was largely a function of her appearance. Even recent studies show that how attractive a woman is rated is very highly correlated with whether or not she will be downwardly or upwardly socially mobile in her life. Nonetheless, there does seem to be some growing pressure on males in connection with the sort of the youth cult and the fitness craze. I go back and forth about whether to be sorry to see men get into this or glad to see them finally get theirs. But there is a tendency, I think, to blame the problems that women have around appearance on men, and it may not be correct. That is, this may be a pure projection. The research actually shows that men, in fact, like women to be considerably heavier than women think men like them to be, okay? Men don't buy into the same ideal of thinness. And maybe there's some sort of primordial intuition operating here, because all the evidence would suggest that women are intended by nature to be fatter. At puberty, a woman's body, the natural course of events is for a woman to add a great deal of body fat. For a male, this is not true. For women, the implications of body fat for health are very, very different. It appears that the mortality rates do not increase in a woman until she is well over 200 pounds. For men, fatness begins to have some effect on health and mortality at much lower levels. And finally, a certain minimum of body fat is necessary for reproduction. And again, this makes sense if you think about it. There's been no guarantee through history that when a woman got pregnant, she could automatically have access to a greatly increased food supply. She had to carry that extra storage with her if she was to survive pregnancies. It may be that one piece of our current preference for thinness has to do with the lesser value placed on children and having children in our era. Well, okay, you may say, that's interesting, but aren't the issues around weight and eating pretty straightforward? I mean, what is there really to talk about? If you want to weigh less, you just stop overeating, right? Actually, that's very wrong. And that's the first thing that I want to talk about is the misinformation that most of us have labored under most of our lives and that I think contributes to the problems very greatly. Our understanding of weight regulation began with research in the 1920s and very nearly ended there. At that time, very careful work was done determining the caloric contents of different foods and balance studies done in human subjects in which it was found that if you gave them foods of known calories, you could predict the changes in fat storage. And so the whole notion of calories in, calories out that we all live by today came out of this research. And at that point, the book was really closed. Everyone thought, well, that's a simple story. Even at the time, there were some perplexing findings that just got swept under the rug. One of the problems with this research we can see in retrospect was that it used very few subjects. Most of everything that's known about energy expenditure comes from two or three normal weight males. So, of course, it was impossible to find out anything about individual differences when there was no variability in the subject study. But one interesting finding, even from the 20s, was one of the researchers who was prominent at that time was a man named Gulick, who did an experiment on himself. And he began first by calculating about how many calories he normally ate a day. It came out to about 2,700. So for 53 days, he ate 2,700 calories a day, or kept very careful tally of it. During that time, he lost 1 pound. He then increased his calorie intake to 3,500 calories a day for 73 days. During this time, he gained only 6 pounds. Now, when you calculate the number of excess calories, how many pounds that should have produced, what it shows is that 500 of the 800 extra calories per day that he was eating simply disappeared. And so did the finding. Well, time went by, and soon every physician in the country and every person in the country believed the same thing, that this was a very simple matter and that if people overate, they were fat, and if they were fat, they overate. The fact that treatment almost always failed posed no problem for this theory because since it was not under the control of the physician, the patient was sent home with instructions, it was easy to assume that they'd failed to carry out the instructions. Perhaps we should have been puzzled by the fact that the cure rate for obesity was worse than for the worst forms of cancer, that fewer people succeeded in giving up these alleged food addictions than gave up heroin addiction, that it probably was harder to believe that all obese people had less ego strength and capability of self-control than drug addicts. But even so, there was very little change in our thinking about it, and the reopening of these issues came about in some roundabout ways through other lines of research later on. One of these had to do with the studies of BMH lesioned rats. All of you who've had psych courses will remember that these are the rats who, after being given a lesion in the ventromedial hypothalamus, turn into little rat balls. They just overeat tremendously and become extremely obese. Well, at the same time, it was found that lesions in the lateral hypothalamus produced a rat that didn't eat and lost weight, and so there was great excitement that we had found the hunger and satiety centers. But as research continued, a few findings turned up, even with this model, that began to raise some questions. For example, VMH lesion rats didn't overeat indefinitely. They overate till they reached a certain weight, and then they stopped. And if you force-fed them and put them above that weight, when the force feeding was over, they went on a diet and came back down to it. If you starved them and brought them below that weight, they ate back up to that weight and no further. And so, in fact, this weight was very carefully regulated. It also turned out that if you didn't allow them to overeat, they still were quite susceptible to weight gain. And, in fact, the physiological psychologist began and looked at these rats to see that the issue was that until they reached that weight, everything they ate was going into storage, meaning that they had no food available to them and were still hungry, and that this became a reason for overeating. The physiological psychologist Stricker summed it up by saying, the animal gets fat not because it overeats, but overeats because it is getting fat. This would be analogous to one of you having a checking account in which no matter how much money you deposit, it was immediately put into five-year savings certificates, so that no matter how big your income, you could never afford a meal or a pair of socks. And this seemed to be exactly what was happening to these rats. At around the same time, research began on genetic strains of genetically obese animals. And what was very quickly found with these animals was that, again, while they would overeat if given the opportunity, if their food was restricted, they still gained weight. And they achieved just about the same degree of obesity they would with unrestricted access to food. In other words, they were capable of making the metabolic adjustments necessary to become fat, even on subnormal intakes. They also showed an inability to increase metabolic rate under conditions in which normal animals' metabolic rate would go up. For example, I think this is sort of interesting, most genetically obese strains of animals will die if they're left in the cold because they can't raise their metabolic rate enough to fend off death from hypothermia. Well, then still another line of studies were begun, which are known as the overfeeding studies. The idea here was to take a normal thin person and overfeed them and make them fat, and then look at the physiological changes so that we could begin to tease out. There were many things that were associated with fatness, but it wasn't really clear that fatness caused them. They might both be caused by a gene that produced them both, or something in childhood feeding or whatever. So research was begun with normal subjects, first using prisoners as volunteers. The first four subjects studied by Sims and Horton in Vermont ate 2 to 3 times their normal intake for 3 to 5 months and gained on the average only 10% of their body weight, which calculates out to be a very, very small percent of the predicted weight gain. Some subjects in this regimen gained nothing at all. A couple lost weight. Moreover, when the overfeeding parts of the experiment were over, their weights would return very rapidly back to baseline. In trying to understand this, people began looking at the metabolic rates of subjects who were overfed and soon discovered that with overfeeding, two things occurred. There was first a substantial increase in basal metabolic rate, that is how many calories are burned just what you would burn if you just lay in bed all day. What's burned just to keep the body warm and going. And that furthermore, right after a meal, extra heat would just be produced and blown off in air, and that was the end of it. So it appeared that naturally thin people were able to overeat without gaining weight, or without gaining weight at nearly the rate that other people did. The tendency to be able to waste calories in this way turned out to be much stronger in lean people. If you studied fat people and overfed them, they converted that food to fat to a much greater extent than did the naturally thin people. At the same time, people were looking at what happens to metabolism during weight loss. And it was found that, evidently as a way of protecting the body from death by starvation, metabolic rate dropped by as much as 50% in the face of starvation. And it dropped more in fat people than it did in thin people, so that they were better conservers. What's even more striking, and this is probably the area where I predict there will be the most work done in the next 10 or 15 years to try to clarify some very startling findings, having to do with what happens. We know metabolic rate drops during the diet, but what happens after the diet? What happens during that period of regain? In one very striking study, Boyle and his colleagues took a group of rats, divided them in half, and had half of them lose 20% of their body weight. So these are now underweight rats and normal rats. He then put them back on the diet that the normal rats were eating, and on the same diet, as a matter of fact, it was a little less because he adjusted it to their body weight. In a fixed period of time, the rats who had been dieted gained 29.6 grams, while the rats who had never been dieted gained 1.6 grams. In other words, there was an 18-fold difference in metabolic efficiency during this period of time. Or looked at another way, the rats who had been food deprived never had to be given that food that they'd missed to catch up with the others. A recent study by Brownell and his colleagues at University of Pennsylvania suggests that this effect is progressive. They have put rats on what they call yo-yo dieting studies, where they have them lose weight, gain it, lose it, gain it. And what they find is that by the second diet, the rate of weight loss on the same calorie intake is cut in half. The rate of regain after the second diet is doubled. Well, my husband and I and our colleagues were looking at all this research and thinking, it's beginning to look like someone could be fat without overeating. And so we thought it was time to go back and take a look at all the studies which had measured food intake in fat and lean people. And when we did this in 1976, we found 20 studies that had measured the average food intake in fat and thin people. Some were done in laboratories, which had an element of artificiality. Some were done using food diaries, which have a potential for error. But they covered a range of techniques, and the point is that there was a striking consensus. 19 out of 20 of the studies found that the fat people ate the same or less than the thin people. One study had used two measures. One measure showed the fat people eating more, the other showed them eating less. The researchers concluded that the one that showed them eating less must be a bad measure and that they ate more. Well, what this has all amounted to is that a very new picture of obesity and weight regulation has emerged, even though it's not all that well disseminated among physicians at this point or all that well understood by most people. And what it amounts to is that weight is regulated, that the major factor in what weight a person will have is probably genetic, and that the body will fight any changes from the genetically established weight or weight range. A very, I think, convincing study addressing this is one that you may have seen written up in the papers about a year ago, in which the researchers went to Denmark, where very careful records are kept of adoptions, and health data is kept on the adoptive and biological parents in a way that's not available in this country. So they were able to look at the adult weights of children adopted at birth or within 4 weeks of birth and see how that related to the weights of their biological parents from whom they'd been separated and their adoptive parents. And what they found was that there was no relationship whatsoever to the weights of the adoptive parents and a definite relationship to the weights of the biological parents. In what I thought was one of the greater lapses of logic I've seen in my field, the author said, well, we shouldn't let this discourage us. It just means that we need to start prevention efforts sooner. And I thought to myself, I wonder what they have in mind. What interventions could one possibly come up with that would be more potent than separating a child from its natural parents at birth and raising them with the kind of family that should make them thin? Let me have the next slide and just summarize for you what the set point model says. Now, set point is still a theoretical concept. This is not as clear-cut as a thermostat, although it's often likened to it. But essentially, what this model says is that there is some weight range, which is regulated, relatively stable throughout adult life, and that if you go above it, you will tend to be pushed back down by the fact that there will be an increase in metabolic rate and a decrease in hunger. If you go below it, you will tend to be pushed back up by the fact that there will be a decrease in metabolic rate and an increase in hunger. Now, the question that gets asked is, does this mean that a person cannot get below their set point or above it? And no, it doesn't mean that. Let's talk about getting below it, because very few people that I know are interested in getting above it. yes, you can get below your set point, you can stay below your set point, but you very well may pay an awesome price for doing this. The most informative studies on the effects of going below a normal body weight actually were not studies of dieting, but were studies conducted during World War II by Keith Brozek and their colleagues at the University of Minnesota. And if any of you ever want to read a beautiful piece of research, I would recommend these two volumes to you. They became interested in this topic during the war because it was anticipated that wartime would bring famine and that there would be a problem of caring for large populations of starved people, and they wanted to anticipate what these problems were like. The subjects recruited into this study were conscientious objectors who didn't want to go into battle but were willing to participate as subjects here. I suspect most of them probably would have thought later that battle would have been easier. They were placed on diets calculated to produce weight loss. The average diet for this group was about 1,700 calories a day, which is hardly what we would call a killer diet today. And they were left on that until they had lost, I think it was 20% of their initial body weight. And through the process of weight loss and then through the process of weight restoration, they were meticulously studied. And some of the major findings were that with this starvation, but I put starvation in quotes. Again, I want to emphasize, this is a diet much milder than our average dieter today thinks of as just a minimum diet. One of the major effects was immensely impaired concentration, which is to say that they became stupider. They had a very substantially decreased capacity for physical work, which is to say that they became much weaker. They showed changes on psychological tests in virtually all subscales reflecting neurosis, which is to say that they became mentally ill and in particular very depressed. They were obsessed with food. It was the major topic of conversation among the men. It was the major subject in their dreams. They reported that they daydreamed about it. One of my husband's favorite statistics is that, I may have the number not quite right, but I think 18 of the 36 began collecting recipes. And they experienced a profound loss of interest in everything but food and eating. For example, there was very little interest left in sex. The other interesting finding was what happened. Most of the men were able to adhere to the rules of the study during the restriction period, and this is a truth that's well known to dieters, that it's easier, the less you eat in some ways, the easier it is. There seems to be an ability to inhibit hunger. But during the period when they were given access to food, they were actually supposed to be in groups refed at different rates. That part of the study got rapidly out of control because once the food was made available to these men, they lost control, and it was not unusual for them to eat 2,000, 4,000, 6,000, 8,000 calories in a sitting. Even though they were told this would ruin the study, and they were very conscientious men, even though they were told it was dangerous. And this had been the experience, incidentally, with explorers brought in who were told if you eat too much, it could kill you, and they eat too much. Luckily, it doesn't kill you too often. But, in fact, what we're saying is that they became bulimic. That when they had access to food, they could no longer control it. And they would say, I don't know why I'm eating so much. I feel terrible. I'm so full, I can't stand it. Some of them would throw up because they couldn't bear the feeling of that much food in their stomach at once. This is exactly the way that bulimia begins. The only difference is that these men had no interest in staying at the weight they were at. They wanted to get back to their normal size and get out of the study and go home. For a dieting person today, when the binges set in, the loss of control, there's a real panic response. The whole purpose of the thing to begin with was to be thin. And when one experiences the fact that it's no longer possible to control eating, that there will be these huge intakes of food that you cannot seem to master, then you get desperate and you start thinking, well, now what am I going to do? And the idea of getting rid of it by throwing up, of taking laxatives, which incidentally does not save calories, that's sort of a mythical thing one does, but or by following a binge by a period of total fasting or by going out and compulsively exercising. These are very logical steps to take if you're at that point. And this is exactly what happens in eating disorders. a group of researchers at Rockefeller University studied obese subjects put on strict diets in the hospital and gave many of the same tests that Keyes and Brozek had used, and found that even though these subjects were overweight and very overweight, that they suffered the same symptoms that Keyes and Brozek's subjects had. Well, in the 50s when I grew up, only a few poor souls like myself were dieting. Most people didn't have to lose weight to look like Anita Ekberg or Jane Mansfield or Marilyn Monroe. In fact, the big scam at that time were all the ways to increase your breast size, all sorts of exercising devices and nutritional supplements and whatnot. There wasn't much in the backs of magazines on diets, although you could buy tapeworms from Mexico. So there has been a big change. And to emphasize this point, I would like to show you a brief history of the world. Could I have the next slide? The world, if you recall, began in the Garden of Eden. Fat women in those days appeared to be happy. In fact, they didn't even call them fat women, they just called them women. They ate all the apples they wanted. They were very fond of picnics. And they were very popular at picnics, too. Now, I think this is fascinating. Here we have evidence that it was possible in those days for a woman to sit unclothed without studying the insides of her thighs. Here's another one, not even looking down. She seemed to like the way she looked. But this Eden was not to last forever. There's some sort of ominous gathering force here. She tries to ignore it for a while. Well, it got to the point where it could not be ignored. Okay, now we jump forward in time a little. This is the same woman, but she looks very different in a polyester pantsuit. And what we see is that she has suffered an incredible loss of dignity over the centuries. Nobody believes her anymore. And so to try to save face in a society in which she's been made to be a real buffoon, she exercises. She exercises more. She picks out clothes suitable for a modern woman, jockey shorts. And so emerges our lovely modern woman, looking lean and very hungry. That's all for now. The vast majority of women now, as our first slide showed, feel too fat, and the vast majority diet. I think these statistics are pretty alarming. About 8 years ago, it was found that 80% of girls were on their first diet by the time they're 14. A new finding out of California now shows that 80% of fifth grade girls are on their first diet. And before long, many of these are going to suffer very predictable consequences. They're going to find that the rate of weight loss on a given type of diet decreases. They're going to find that they gain weight much more easily. They're going to find that they are subject to eating binges. They're going to find that they're depressed and begin to feel overwhelmed by this and sort of lose a grip on their situation. When this happens and they become desperate, some turn to total starvation, become anorexic, which, as you know, is a disorder characterized by continuous extreme food restriction, loss of at least 25% of body weight, and loss of menses. Anorexia has increased somewhat in the last 10 or 20 years, but not nearly so much as bulimia, which has increased dramatically. And bulimia, of course, is the alternation of losses of control, intakes of very large amounts of food, followed by some kind of compensatory behavior. Again, vomiting, laxative use, exercising or fasting. The studies which have come out in the last few years suggest that about 15 to 20% of women of college age have bulimia to some extent. Dr. Keith earlier quoted the finding of 50%. If you look at some bulimic behaviors, that's probably correct. Now, one question that's asked is this really different? Have there always been this many bulimics and they just didn't come in for treatment? It's always a difficult question to answer, but this next slide, I think, gives us some information on that. This is from the Glamour study again, and these women were asked, have you ever used self-induced vomiting as a method of weight control? And what you can see is that among the women over 40, only 1.8% ever used that within their lifetime. Among women under 20, it's 19.5%, and a very orderly relationship there, suggesting a steady increase. Well, I think it's a very interesting question. Why does everybody want to be thin now? What's going on? In fact, this is somewhat of a rarity across time and across culture. There's only been a few periods in history when this was the case. Let me show you a slide that I think has something to say. This is a study done by Brett Silverstein, who went through Vogue and Ladies' Home Journal from 1901 to 1981, looked at the editorial content and advertisements, and just worked out curvaceousness ratios, the ratios of bust to waist and hips to waist. And what you find is that there are two periods, not just the current time, but now and in the 20s, when the preference for a curvaceous body has dropped way, way down and the tubular look came in. I think this is a clue if we can read it. Different people will come up with different interpretations, but remembering that this is a phenomenon among women, what was going on for women during this time? Well, this is the time of the suffrage movement. Some of you may not be aware of it, but there was an attempt to pass an equal rights amendment, which failed, just as it did here. And the look of the flappers was commonly described in the press as a boyish look. Well, I think that what happens is that at times when women are trying to move into the male world and to achieve male prerogatives, that there is an emulation of the male body that comes in as a fashion. Yes, thinness is in fashion, but what is fashion? Well, what fashion historians tell us, and I hadn't realized this, I was very fascinated, fashion is an attempt by those who are not in power to emulate those who are. And throughout history, what would happen is that rich and powerful people would signal their importance by wearing and going in a carriage or whatever different from what other people had. As soon as that became known, all the other people would scramble to get it. And then as soon as they got it, to distinguish themselves, they had to change. They had to do something different. And this is why fashion changes, because you always have to keep ahead of your imitators, and it takes them a while to get together the money and resources and catch up with you. Well, the point that I want to underscore is that we are in an enormous transition now. And I think that young women today are faced with an exceedingly difficult psychological task. Think about it. For the first time in history that I can think of, when a girl reaches maturity, she's asked to model her adult life not after her mother, but after her father. She has to make a complete and total change in identification. And in our view, serious eating disorders reflect a summation of the impact of dieting, which I've already discussed, the effect on that, the tendency to produce binge eating, and the tremendous conflicts about the adult role, the extreme difficulty of passage from adolescence into adulthood at this point in our history. Catherine Steiner-Adair, a student of Carol Gilligan's at Harvard, found that adolescents most likely to have eating disorders were ones who subscribed to the superwoman image of adulthood. They wanted to fill a male role, and they also wanted to have a baby on a hip that didn't have a briefcase. But the other interesting thing was that in comparison to the subjects who seemed less disturbed about eating, they were unable to recognize that there were contradictory elements in this picture, unable to articulate the conflict in any way, let alone begin dealing with it, suggesting once again that in self-knowledge there is some protection. For the last 4 years, we've been running an intensive therapy program for bulimic women. Most of these women come from out of town and spend 4 weeks living in a hotel apartment near the medical school, And then they come over where we see them for 8 hours a day of therapy. It's a very, very intense contact. It allows us to get to know them in ways that we had never been able to get to know patients before. And while I believe that it's a good treatment and it's had a very good outcome, it has also been sort of a laboratory for learning more about bulimia. Let me share with you an incident from therapy and see if you might begin to develop some of the same speculations that we did. Young woman has wanted very much to get into the program. Her weight is low enough that there was some threat of hospitalizing her. She really doesn't want to be in the hospital. She wants to be with us. She arrives the first day, appears very happy to be there, and that night goes to Kroger's, shoplifts some laxatives, gets picked up by the police. The police call her mother. Her mother calls her at the hotel. She's tearful. She's upset. She says she feels so awful she might kill herself. So not too surprisingly, her mother comes down to the hotel. The next morning, she comes in for therapy, and she complains, "My mother is so overprotective. I don't know why she had to come down last night." And she isn't able to get anywhere with talking about this. No insight into why she's done this. Switch to read here. So I give up on that line of questioning and say, "Could you pretend you are your mother and talk about your life?" This is a transcript I'm reading you. She says, "You mean what she would say?" "Yes." "Well, I know she's going to call me up today, and I know what she'll say. It may be important to say what she wouldn't ordinarily say, but what you know she feels. About me or her?" "About her. Say, I'm Marie's mother." And she says, "I'm Marie's mother. I'm very worried about Marie. I know she's old enough to be an adult, but still I feel she needs a mother. I'd feel useless if I didn't have her. What else do I have to do in my life? I'm not very talented. I'm no good. I shouldn't be a substitute teacher because I don't have my degree, and I don't feel I'm really in control of the children. I know I shouldn't be teaching them. I'm just, you know, they just call me because I just keep the kids in line. I don't really know enough that I should actually be teaching." Well, what is this all about? I think that one of the things going on for this young woman is that she's taking care of her mother, that she's very concerned about her mother and her, the devaluation of her role, the lack of meaning in her life, and that by staying bulimic, this is one way to help her mother out. We always think of parents taking care of their children, but in fact, children do a great deal to take care of their parents. Some of you may be familiar with the literature on alcoholic families that shows in an alcoholic family, one child, usually an older child, will become what they call the hero who goes out and performs very well in the world and brings credit to the family to offset the effects of the alcoholism. Another child, usually a younger one, becomes what's known as a mascot, entertains the family, tries to keep things light in the face of all this chaos and fear. Well, I think that in families in which the mother is unhappy, in which her life and role have been sharply devalued, that the bulimic daughter is the one who helps out. She gives her a reason to remain a mother. She is often her mother's major confidant, the one who listens to her about the disappointments of her life and her marriage. And she performs well, pleases the family. Sometimes it almost looks as though she is working to keep her father at home by keeping him interested. She may become a superb athlete, so her father goes to the family to her athletic events. She may make herself so attractive and pleasing that he, in a sense, takes her out on dates. The daughter is trying both to support her mother and to escape her plight. And she may see all traditionally female attributes as tickets to despair: a womanly body, any expressions of emotional need, any dependence or interdependence. She wants instead to be tough, to have a hard, lean body, to be in control of her behavior and in control of her feelings, which means that these feelings get bottled up and she's not dealing with her pain. Binging often offers relief from inner pain that's not being dealt with in other ways. And maybe the only area in which she allows herself some loss of control, so that it's vitally important to her. Some of the most common themes in, I'm getting short on time here, aren't I? I'll go quickly here. Some of the most common themes in treatment of bulimic women have been, first of all, unresolved grief and painful issues from the past that have not been dealt with because she felt she had to be strong. Secondly, a sense that puberty was a time when she was going to become like her mother and was therefore experienced in a very conflictual way, because to become like her mother, as she understood it at that point, was to become something that was no longer valued. Excessive loyalty to the mother and to family members, or anger at her for not being a role model. Underdeveloped friendships because so much energy is still invested in the family. And finally, and this was a surprising finding, a great deal of sexual abuse. We found that 58% of our patients have been victims of incest or childhood molestation, and that this becomes probably a very important contributing factor to their sense of shame. Unfortunately, victims of sexual abuse blame themselves, if I hadn't been needy, if I hadn't wanted attention or affection, this would never have happened. And that shame becomes referred to the body, and the dieting is in part a self-purification effort to get rid of this flesh which caused the trouble. Well, I have 2 minutes, and I want to get back to probably the reasons you guys really came, which was not to hear all this, but to know, how can you tell if you have an eating disorder? If it's on your mind all the time, if it's becoming obsessional, it's a problem. Nobody else can really tell that but you. Can it be cured? Yes. It can be cured, and not just the eating part, but it should be possible to leave those concerns behind, to feel comfortable with your body, to like yourself, and to lead a normal life. How can you tell if you're at set point? You can't with any total precision, but if you're at a weight that you're able to maintain spontaneously without a great deal of dieting, that's it. That's your set point. Your body will naturally gravitate there. If there was a time in your life when that was true, that's probably a natural set point weight for you. Finally, what's the best way to lose weight? And I know that's what you really want to know. The very best way to lose weight is to get into a teleportation device like they had in The Fly and get your genetic material intermixed with a naturally thin person. The worst way is to go on a crash diet, which will depress your metabolism, cause you to regain weight very easily at the other end, and you will just dig yourself a deeper and deeper hole. People do sometimes get above set point. Small changes in weight are possible. The best way to do it, if you're going to do it, but I urge you to remember that it's easier to change your body image than your body, but the best way to do it is to do it as gradually as possible so that you don't threaten your body, you don't set these conserving responses in motion. The smallest cut in intake that will produce a steady weight loss of any rate is the best way. Paired with moderate exercise, extreme exercise does the same thing that starvation does. It scares your body. It says, we're in trouble, hang on to everything you got. So, good luck to you all, and I hope you can remember you are more than just a body.
Today, University Forum has presented Susan Clark Woolley, Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine. She spoke on weight gain may be in your genes, eating disorders in college students today. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is a private undergraduate liberal arts college located in Lincoln, Nebraska. Approximately 1,300 students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.